Hey, this is Sucks for Madness. As you can see, in a very dull and grey English seaside town, every day is like Sunday. And you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Oh yes, oh yes, 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 you know what time it is. It is time for episode number 188 of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor, with your host, me, Chris Shiflett, coming to you like every time. Can you believe that? 188 episodes of Walking the Floor. We're closing in on the 200 episode mark, which is insane. Do I get something for that when we hit that milestone? I don't know. Send me presents, listeners. Send me presents. You know, I'm recording this episode on Tuesday, but it's not posting till Monday. So hopefully the world doesn't fall apart between those two points and I seem all out of date. But I got to do this one early this week because I'm heading out to Nashville tomorrow to go record some new solo material. Not making a new album, exactly. Just recording some tunes. Don't even know what I'm going to do with them, but I'm going to do something with them. I'm going to put them out, you know, pretty soon. Going to put them out pretty soon. Some new tracks. Got a whole bunch of new COVID songs, and I got to get out there and get them recorded and figure out how I'm going to put them out. But they're going to come out soon, new solo tracks. I also planted a bunch of seeds this week. You know, let me tell you something. Let me tell you our big COVID idea. When we were just sitting around at home last year, was like, let's get rid of the skate ramp in the yard because my kids don't use it anymore and it's rotten, and let's build some garden beds, which seems like a really good idea, but unfortunately what we did was we built them in a part of my yard that gets like almost no sunshine. Apparently you need sun to grow vegetables and fruits and flowers and things like that, but I didn't realize that ahead of time. Nobody told me. And so now I've got these beautiful garden beds in a part of my yard where they're really just doesn't get a lot of sun. So if you have any gardening tips, please direct message me or, you know, tweet at me, whatever. Send me a note. What grows without sun? That's what I need to know. I got a bunch of stuff. I got a bunch of seeds coming up right now. And, you know, I got like melons and stuff and flowers and some cucumbers and onions and all that kind of stuff. It's going to be a nice spring planting, but I think I'm going to have to plant it in like a big pot or something and just not have it in my beautiful garden beds, which kind of blows, but I guess I should have done a little more research ahead of time. So send me your gardening tips, people. Send me your gardening tips. And in the meantime, let's talk about Zounds.com. Zounds.com, the greatest musical instrument retailer on the planet. Did you know that you get free shipping on every order? No exceptions, no exclusions. The best gear from the best brands over at Zounds. You never have to pay full price all at once, and they never charge you interest. So get on over to Zounds.com. Get what you need. And as for us, we're going to get to today's interview. All right, so Madness just put out a fantastic new compilation record called Our House, The Very Best of Madness. Came out just a week or two ago, and it's a great collection of some of their best tunes, and I had the absolute pleasure of getting to talk to Suggs, lead singer of Madness, who I could have just, honestly, I could have talked to this guy all day. He was so much fun to talk to. I could just listen to him talk all day, man. He is like the perfect English gentleman. He's just London personified. And I gotta tell you, I had about 3 pages of questions and we barely got through the first page. I don't even think we got past like 1984. There was just so much to talk to him about. If you love two-tone, if you love ska, if you love that whole era, and all the stuff that they've done since. I mean, they beautiful, beautiful, beautiful songs. We didn't even get into the songwriting, man. I gotta get Suggs back on again. Consider this like part one of what could be an ongoing, you know, semi-regular appearance from Suggs for Madness. I could just listen to this dude tell stories all day long. He was the coolest. This is Suggs from Madness on Walking the Floor.
I'll tell you a funny thing. Our sound man of 30 odd years standing retired just before COVID. I said, I swear, he's got some sort of biblical revenge. He wasn't supposed to retire the whole business. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he put a curse on us all.
He's so happy. You know, we're all just sitting there with our feet up. The same boat as he is, yeah.
Hey, where are you right now?
I'm at the coast in England in a place called Whitstable.
Oh, okay.
It's great. It's where my wife's from. And we came down for a weekend just before the lockdown. And in fact, being in London was even more depressing. Do you know what I mean? Because everything's shut and all the places you would normally go to. And, you know, half the reason we're living in the city is the hustle and bustle. So, and we've just been here for a year, which has been great because we've got the beach and all that. I'm not saying it's, I mean, there's a lot of people out there swimming, but I'm not one of them. I can tell you that much. There's a lot of people going in for this freezing cold swimming. It's like a sort of fad down here.
Jesus. Really? Yeah. What, like going out there, like what do they call them, the polar bears or whatever?
Exactly. And they have these great big outfits that look like so the guards at Buckingham Palace. Yeah, it's really bizarre.
Oh, nice. I'll tell you, one time I was over there and on tour, and I went surfing down around Cornwall, and I couldn't believe it. It was like warmer. I don't remember what time of year I was there, but it was warmer than it was back home in California in the water.
Yeah, a microclimate down there. That's right. Yeah, you can get a microclimate on the Gulf Stream or whatever. That's right.
Yeah.
You get palm trees and all that. Yeah, I know, it's fantastic. But it can get very cold as well. I remember going down there one time and there were ice, the puddles were iced up, man. I was walking through and I had these kind of swimming socks on, you know, these little sort of polyurethane. And I thought my toes had fallen off. It was just a bit of sand. I lost my toes.
Yeah.
Now down here where we are, the southeast coast, it's warmer than some, but it's still pretty cold out there. Yeah. So where are you at the moment?
I'm here at home in Los Angeles. I live in LA. Yeah.
Jolly good.
Yeah. It's cold. It actually hailed here last night, which
did
is
it? Yeah.
Totally out of character. You know, I was thinking about this last night. Like, my kids, because of the time that they've grown up, my kids are all teenage boys. They don't know rain. We don't have rain here anymore, like on any kind of regular basis. And then out of the blue last night it hailed. It sounded like people were throwing rocks at our house. Very strange.
Yeah, funny. Well, that's one thing we have in common, because it was hailing here as well. So there you go. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of that going on, isn't there? Yeah.
You know,
on new climate business.
My 13-year-old son actually recently, seemingly out of the blue, started listening to a lot of Madness, and I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Kid.
Like,
you know,
great son. I raised him right. I want you to know that. And I was kind of like, I was interested in that. And then I realized that a bunch of his friends were also listening to Madness.
How funny.
And I thought, like, you know, you must have seen this many times over the years. Like, you know, young people getting into your music and getting into like mod and getting into like ska and, you know, what mod revivals, you know, here and there and all that sort of thing. And Madness is like one of those bands that I seemingly like every new generation discovers. They just rediscover it over and over, you know?
No, it's funny you should say that, because obviously we were never as big in America as we were in the UK. But we always had a good following in California, for sure. And there was a lot of offshoots, as you know, as you said, there was revivals. You know, you think, but was it Fishbone, I remember, when we first went there. And then that was the beginning of the Chili Peppers and all that, which wasn't the same, but it was that kind of vibe, you know, post-punk kind of jumping up and down to sort of funky music.
Right.
And it keeps going round and round and round. But I do recall, funny enough, when we were becoming big in this country, we were kind of like the same, a bit of a sort of cult ska band. And of course, you had the whole two-tone scene with the Specials and Selector, and that was a very big phenomenon. And then we kind of went off and went in a sort of slightly more eclectic direction with Stiff Records, which was perfect for us, because Stiff at that time had all the Mavericks, you know, like Elvis Costello and Ian Dury, who was one of our heroes, and a lot of other great bands, The Damn, Nick Lowe. So it was just the perfect place for us, and it was an independent label. So we felt sad about leaving the two-tone scene, but we were onto something that was kind of more tailored for us, if you know what I'm saying, because we wanted to go off, you know, we loved the Kinks, and we loved the Beatles, and we loved all sorts of different things that weren't just ska, even though that was our main fundament. But I remember when we brought out the song Baggy Trousers, and we did a video where our saxophone player flies, And for some reason, that captured the imagination of every under 15-year-old boy. They'd gone from being this sort of almost cool kind of thing to suddenly being this, like, just tsunami of kids in vests in the freezing cold with all the badges. And I remember we had to actually do a matinee tour because every gig we did, there were thousands of kids that couldn't get in, you know, for the licensing reasons. And we did, I think we did 24 shows, yeah. So we did two shows a day, one for under-18s and one. And the ones for the under-18s were actually wilder than the older ones.
Really?
We had this magician on. He only lasted three gigs. These kids were all throwing bottles at him. You almost see a band, man. No fucking shows, cartoons and magicians. And I remember he bags and left. But I think maybe something to do with those videos as well. Do you know what I mean? Now that great thing of being able to look stuff up on YouTube, it seems to resonate still with kids, which is great. Yeah, I mean, we were kids when we made those early records, of course.
Well, it's interesting. You know, that time, like, culture just didn't move as fast globally back then.
Sure,
you know, so I was in junior high around like 83, 84. And, you know, of course, we had MTV, and so your videos were all over MTV. And I remember, you know, at my junior high, there were, like, you know, all these different little subcultures. You know, you had the heavy metal kids, and you had the punkers, and you had some goths, and there was, like, a group of mods, you know? But, and that were all into the two-tone stuff, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
In the interest of, you know, full disclosure, I was not part of that group, but I was friends with that group. But, like, you know, this would have been, like I said, like 83, 84 when, and I think you guys started touring over here maybe around that time, what, like 84 or something like that. So what did you make of the sort of the American, particularly the West Coast sort of take on two-tone culture and mod? Like, because if I'm understanding the timeline correctly, like, you know, the Specials and Selector would have broken up by then, and you know, English Beat would have become General Public, and you guys had evolved musically into something sort of beyond the initial ska stuff you were doing. Like,
what do you
make of all these kids, the Button Boys and all that stuff showing up at your shows, like, you know, doing their American version of it?
Yeah, well, it was funny, you know, because, I mean, I think, like all kids at that age, we were a bit snobbish, you know, about the rest of the planet in general, really. You know, we had our own little bubble. I mean, we started out as a gang of friends and, you know, we had our own scene in North London where we grew up, and anything sort of beyond that was a kind of bonus, and it just kept going, you know. But I remember, because, you know, when you think about, I mean, obviously there's all sorts of conversation about the word punk. I mean, you had punk, of course, you had the Stooges and all, but what we called punk was obviously Johnny Rotten and the Clash and all that. I remember that came to California a bit later on. So you had, I don't know, who was it? What was it, the Kennedys? Dead Kennedys, yeah. Black Flag. Yeah. And it all seemed a bit sort of like after the event sort of thing. And that's sort of what it felt a bit like for us, that we'd become a kind of cult, which was lovely. And then we met some really nice people and they were really into what we did. And I remember No Doubt hanging about as kids and all that. But it kind of felt like we'd sort of missed the boat somehow a little bit. Do you know what I mean? That we'd been sort of compartmentalized into something that was sort of novelty almost, rather than, you know, we just come from a cultural revolution, man. Do you know what I mean?
Right. We're
playing this gig, go-go, which is great fun. You know, I mean, really happy times. But I remember then just looking over the vastness of middle of America and thinking, this just ain't going to happen, man. Do you know what I mean? The boat is gone, man. My boat's a Garo, disappeared over the horizon. Because you know what it's like, and you did it yourself, you know, because you play one state and the college radio maybe be playing your, but then you go to the next state and you have to keep going round, don't you? You have to be relentless going round. And
yeah,
at that point, we'd already been around Europe a lot of time. So we just kind of, we love coming to America and we love meeting them people, but we kind of realized that it probably wasn't going to take off, you know, like it had for us.
Really? God, that's very, like that, yeah. That my memory of you guys were like massive. You know, I remember, well, I just remember you, like your videos were just always on MTV.
No, I mean, I'm not, you know, shortly after that, I mean, I think we did come in like the early 80s. That really was the sort of just feeling the water sort of thing. But then Our House did become a big hit. And then we did play much bigger venues and it started to sort of take some kind of shape. But it was a very brief moment in time.
Right, right.
I think it had a lot to do with that. You know, I'm not saying, like I say, it was some sort of, not arrogance, but it was just, we'd all just had kids as well. So, you know, we'd been touring for you know, it's like 3 or 4 years, you know, just yeah. doing what we're supposed to be doing, promoting albums three singles a year. So everyone's getting a bit tired as well. And just the vastness of America sort of did us in, really. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough nut to crack, for sure.
I saw a lot of bands, you know. I mean, I remember we were contemporaries of the Pretenders, you know, and they did that. They toured for 18 months. And I just wanted to get home at that point. Yeah, I was tired, man. And then I remember seeing bands like the Psychedelic Furs, who were sort of, I mean, chronologically contemporaries of ours. I remember them being completely done in some hotel room in California with the curtains drawn, sitting in the corner, sort of going like that. Can't take it anymore. But some great memories, man. You know, and I've been very happy that that's been the way it is. And I think maybe that's got something to do with why each generation finds us, because it almost feels to them they've discovered something themselves. Right. You know what I mean? Because it's not in their faces. Yeah.
You know, my buddy Nat, who was one of those mod kids at my junior high that I was talking about, told me that that Madness fans were almost like singularly into Madness, a greater dedication to Madness specifically than the overall maybe two-tone scene or whatever, mod or whatever it was. Like, did you feel that being in the band, and did that help you guys? Maybe you had less like genre baggage and were able to move into the mainstream maybe a little easier than your
peers. Yeah, I think that's a fair point. You know, and sometimes to the detriment of our really early fans, because they felt we'd gone a bit pop, whatever you call it, like you say, mainstream. That wasn't our intention, but it just happened that, yeah, because the ska thing is still a very potent force in Great Britain, but it did categorize you in a pretty small kind of box, and so we wanted to get out of that. We have a weekend every year. We take over this holiday camp in England, and we have a weekend called the House of Fun, and we get probably about 8,000, and it really is like I remember these French journalists coming and saying it was like going to another planet, you know, it was the planet madness. And they all dress up and they do fancy dress competitions, and I mean, I always thought, you know, we were very London orientated, and I didn't mean that in any sort of egocentric way or even nationalistic. You know, London is extremely cosmopolitan, and that's what we were sort of brought up with. And so all those influences were coming to us, whether it was Irish music, Greek music, you know, Egyptian music. So we wanted to get as much of that as we could. I always remember, but then filter it through who we were, you know, so that it would sound like a Madness record, not just a collection of, you know, eclectic music from world music. But I always remember seeing the what was they called? The Cuban All-Stars or something like that. There was a big band, Ferrer, what's his name? Anyway, it's the first time that American guitarist had done that film. Oh, the point of his
decision. Oh, Ry Cooter. Yeah.
And they came to play in London, and I was blown away. I mean, because they were probably in their 80s. Yeah. I remember the singer came on and it looked absolutely miraculous, you know, with a white cheese cutter and white Oxford bag trousers and two walking sticks. And I thought, oh no, man, what is this? And then he threw the walking sticks in the air and then he went into one.
But the power of music.
The power of music and so invigorating. But also that you knew exactly where that band came from. Do you know what I mean? You could put your finger on exactly where that band came from. And that was kind of our trajectory went, you know, that we were a London band, and then that's sort of who we are, and that created a kind of all-encompassing kind of scenario that people could totally throw themselves into, you know, whether it's dressing up or all the different kind of music that we played. But you're right, yeah. So we had this crossover with the fans of the Specials and Selector, but we definitely got a very dedicated audience of our own, yeah, who bring their own kids and all that, yeah.
Where did you grow up in London? Like, what part of London are you from?
Camden Town is where we were from, and it was an interesting place. It was very Irish. It was where the canal, which was the waterways that traverse England, met the railway. So you had, I think, 70,000 Irish workmen arrived in Camden in the 19th century.
Was your family Irish? Like, are you descended from Irish immigrants?
No, a couple of the band are, but ironically, my family was Scottish, and equally, they were imported to dig, I mean, because it's all dug by hand, of course. You look at those railway sidings, you know, dug by hand, man. So most mostly, yeah, the Scottish didn't settle very well. They just got disparate, whereas the Irish really took up in Camden Town. And the great thing about that, they had really big pubs and they all had function rooms at the back. You know, this was their sort of social life where weddings and funerals and all that would take place. Mm. So the beginning of punk, it was the perfect place to be because they were just basically venues. So you just go around and just say, and they'd give you a gig. They didn't really care how well you could play, so long as they sold a few more pints of Guinness. So we got a residency at a pub called the Dublin Castle, and that really was the turning point for us because you start to build up a bit of a following and then you get a bit of a queue around the block and then the record companies start to hear about you. But what you said, you know, I mean, and for better or for worse, because you can always end up sounding like the grumpy old man, I do think there was something golden about that, what you said. It took a long time to spread around the world. You know, it took a long time to spread out of your own area.
Yeah.
By the time you got to Scotland, it was 3 years later. But it was lovely watching that process build, you know, and feeling it coming. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah,
yeah, it always kind of makes me sad that, like, you know, that my kids don't get that. You had to be like, if you were into underground music of any kind back then, you really had to be committed to it and fail often, you know, at the record store. You'd buy, you know, you'd wind up buying records that were terrible, but the album cover looked cool and you'd be like, I don't know what this is.
No, we used to spend days trying to find a certain pair of trousers in secondhand shops.
You know? Right.
You got to look the part. That's right, sound the part. That'll come afterwards. You know what I mean? We used to spend days arguing about what flipping trousers we were going to wear.
I mean, you talked about being...
Also the same, you know, I mean, I don't know about in LA, but like I said, there were, I mean, even before the COVID thing, so many venues shut down, you know, so many pub venues and bars and clubs. So for young bands, it's just got almost impossible, even without this COVID thing. It's really horrible, yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I hate to tread into grumpy old man territory myself. Yeah. That is definitely I don't think my generation where I grew up realized how good we had it with just the availability of places to play, you know, from keg parties.
They went down shit over there. I don't know who you are over there. Yeah. You know, we start again.
Yeah.
Change your name. Fantastic. Fuck that. Forget all that.
Right.
We don't know who they were.
You know, you talked about like your band having a stamp of like, we're a London band.
Yeah.
Besides the music, what were sort of your main sort of like cultural influences at that time? Because yeah. I mean, obviously you guys have such a distinctly British, you know, and also like, you know, your videos always to me as an American from far away had like a Python-esque, you know, quality to them. So like who were like the influences that I wouldn't know about, you know, the English.
You got that. And also it was a kind of golden period for comedy for some reason on the television, which was pretty rubbish most of the time. But then you had things like Python, exactly. Then you had a guy called Tommy Cooper, which I don't think made it in America, who's just fantastic. And funnily enough, I remember reading, I was quite into Samuel Beckett, and it might not strike you when you see Madness, but when you hear things like Crap's Last Tape and some of his later plays, the idea of the ridiculousness of life, you know, the ridiculousness of repeating the process and expecting a different result, which literally is madness. And we were surrounded by there was Morecambe and Wise. We were coming out of what they called a variety period, where you had a lot of old theatres that had these funny old comedians still knocking about from the 1950s, where their acts were really honed, you know, and what they did was really what's the word, you know, sophisticated, even though they look like fools, you know, and that's what we got into, making those videos. You see somebody sort of dressing up and being a bit stupid and then almost a bit self-conscious, whereas we really threw ourselves into those videos in the same way. I think Monty Python isn't a bad analogy, but there were a lot of those about, yeah. So Tommy Cooper, Morgan Wise, Les Dawson, they're all out there on YouTube somewhere, and they all share this kind of surreal. But I always remember, as I say, Samuel Beckett saying that he loved Tommy Cooper. Tommy Cooper was a guy who supposedly was a magician, but he'd always get the tricks wrong. And it sounds completely stupid. And you knew
that was the act.
And you knew he was going to get the tricks wrong, but it didn't stop you laughing your head off when they did go wrong.
Yeah,
really great stuff. Benny Hill as well. I mean, it was all completely un-PC.
Those were the two things that we got in America. We got Benny Hill
made it.
Monty Python. Yeah, that was, and then the music, you know, like, it's so funny. Like, there's so much British music and British cultural influence in America that I didn't, that I was a fan of, but didn't understand until I finally started touring over there. And then it all kind of made sense. The reference points, you know?
This funny cobweb little gray island that thinks much more of itself than it should. Yeah, you've got to be self-deprecating when you live here. I think that's another thing. Self-deprecation was a big thing. You know what I mean? Right. It's like you do everything seriously, really seriously, but you don't take yourself seriously. You know, right. I think you lot are the same. You know what I mean? When I see your videos,
sure.
You often have that sort of touch of surreal humor often. Yeah.
Yeah.
And amongst ranting and raving and taking on the cops.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just part of our firmament for sure. Yeah. But as you say, yeah, you can't see it when you're in it. You know, I mean, it's only when I look back and reflect. I mean, we've just done a load of documentaries, which is, it's been 40 years since we started. And so there's been some quite serious documentaries. I mean, people are taking this seriously, which is kind of ironic. Because when we started, the other thing was you had this sort of intelligentsia, like the NME and these magazines that were very, very potent, you know, but they never really liked us because we just wouldn't, you know, you had things like New Romanticism, right, which they took really seriously. And you were just going, well, what's that? It's just, you know, it's just a different kind of dressing up.
Right.
And they had all this sort of pomposity around it. And we were just on the other side of the road with a pop balloon, you know, and a party hat, one candle. But it's all good, you know, and again, that period, when you think, when I look back, not that I do all the time, but, you know, you think, you watch Top of the Pops, which is a really crap pop programme, but you would have Adam and the Ants, you'd have the Pretenders, you'd have Blondie from, you know, these really distinct Dexys Midnight Runners, you know, everyone had their own real distinct personality.
Yeah.
Which was a very sort of exciting place to be. I remember every day going to see a different band, every day buying a record, you know, that even if you didn't know what it was, you'd give it a go. And everyone was into music and everyone was talking about music. I still think the kids are, of course, you know, sure, what I mean, in their own different way, and they do it on their phones or whatever.
Yeah.
But going down the record shop and meeting your mates and working out which one you could afford to buy, which one, you know, out of those five records, Talking Heads, go on, let's give that a go. Yeah. And all sitting around listening to these things.
Well, so that's the thing. It was much more of a social, like listening to music was like a social event.
Yeah.
In my youth and probably in your youth, you know.
You go to school with an album and you just, because you, people could tell what you, you know, you'd walk around with it. It was like wearing a badge. Right. Or,
yeah. Or when you saw somebody with like a specific t-shirt, you'd be like, he's in, that he knows what's up, you know.
And that's already starting to tell you which social group you're in. And then people,
right, yeah. Then
people gravitate to you. That's right, yeah.
I mean, what were you listening to pre- ska and two-tone and all that? Like, were you going to see bands like The Clash and The Pistols? Were you part of that?
Yeah. I was very fortunate. I was 15 or 16 and this club called The Roxy started. And it was the first punk club in London. I saw all sorts of crazy bands. Yeah, I remember the first time I went there, I saw a band called Eater. And they were 14. I was 15. For the first time, you know, instead of someone being on a pedestal, they were rolling about on the floor in front of me and they couldn't play very well.
Yeah.
And it was the first indication that, you know, you could do it yourself sort of thing. So that was great. And what was the great thing about the Roxy was there weren't many punk records out at the time. I think there was a bit of the Ramones and I think the first Sex Pistols record, The Damned. But the DJ there was called Don Letts, a black guy, and he used to play reggae records in between because he didn't have any punk records to play. So he had this fantastic collision of this kind of like rebellious reggae music, you know, 2-7's Clash and all that stuff, Peter Tosh. And it was all about that. It sort of fitted the feeling of like, you know, what you call Babylon and the establishment, and we want to do something different and change things, you know.
Was that your
for me,
intrigue?
Because I love reggae. Yeah.
Was that your entry into reggae and then further back into blue beat and ska and all that?
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit. Because then we had this other really funny thing. You had a lot of retro, what we call the Teddy Boys here. You know, we were into 50s rock and roll, Gene Vincent and all that. And that was another thing. They turned up and they were fighting with the punks and there was all that. But then people were going back. So that the Teddy Boys were going back into rockabilly and then going into bluegrass. And it was getting more and more like, sort of like, who's winning? You know, and then we'd be going back into rock steady and then back into ska and then back into Minto, you know, the native music of the West Indies. Like, really? You just try and find something they're never going to imagine. It's so obscure. You're never going to get this one, man. You're never going to get this.
Look what I got. No one's ever heard this.
No one's ever heard this, exactly.
Well, it's interesting, though, because like if that was, say, the mid to late 70s at that point, and if the original sort of mod thing, you know, was in the mid-60s into the late 60s. Mid-60s, so it wasn't really that long after the fact, you know, like had there been a residue just kind of already there of like rude boy culture and ska and stuff? Was that still kind of around in
you've
England
absolutely got it right. Yeah. For us, of course, when you're young, 2 years seems a really long time, or sure. 4 years. But of course, when you look back now, it was so close. You're absolutely right, which gave you access to those clothes. Like I say, you'd find those old suits in secondhand shops, you'd find those hats, and you'd also find those records in market stalls. Well, we had a youth club, and they couldn't afford to buy new records, so they had the record of the previous generation, you know, our brother's records and our uncles and our aunties. So those records were always around and in the firmament. But, you know, in England, we always had that anyway, because you always had people like Desmond Dekker or Toots and the Maytals. We were on the pop radio, do you know what I mean? It wasn't like you were hearing that in amongst the other derivations of pop music. So it was always kind of in the firmament. But then we just got more specific and more. I mean, there's one stall that particularly did the Bluebeat records, which is Prince Buster and all that, and they really were rare. So, you know, it was real kudos if you started collecting these things and sharing them with your friends. I mean, we all used to gather in one pub called the Hope and Anchor, all of us, before the band or anything. And that was the scene, you know, and we had our own little scene. And down the road, in this country, we had soul boys, you know, into like jazz funk. And then just the sort of burgeoning days of punk were starting in the pub next door. And then the goths, as you say, and then the psychobillies and the rockabillies. Every different pub had something going on.
Yeah. Is that how you guys found each other? Is that how the members of Madness found each other at the Hope and Anchor?
It was really. Yeah, it was a very illuminated boss there. They had a tiny little venue downstairs, 40 people. But he let us take over the jukebox because we had, what you'd say, pretty good taste. So we were playing very eclectic stuff, but then we'd have this really rare ska and reggae, and it became a kind of mecca for that. But if the band hadn't sold out, he just let us go downstairs for free. So we'd just see, you know, and that was just an amazing learning process. Seeing all, I mean, I did see the Pretenders down there. I saw Ian Dury down there. I saw Dire Straits down there.
Oh, wow.
Only two numbers, mind. They were very long. It's the old joke. Shit, yeah. Can I open a piss now? Oh, my God, Sultan of whatever. Really need to go.
Sultan of whatever.
This is great. I'll go to the toilet.
Well, if that wasn't inspiration to write 2.5-minute songs, I don't know what could possibly be.
Yeah, well, there you go. And, of course, that another thing, yeah, I mean, all the pop that we love was all like that, you know, short. And then, of course, the Ramones, which I loved as well, you know, on that sort of keep it brief kind of front. Yeah, the idea that you didn't want to overstay your welcome. But the other thing was, you know, we were really into dancing, and it just was the kind of thing, you know, we come from sort of pogoing, which was the same kind of energy, but it just started to get a bit more kind of in time with the music. And, yeah. So that's how the reggae thing fitted in. And also, it was funny, it was like it was smoking marijuana, which was the big thing when I was young. You see all the black kids, you see like the hippies sort of sitting around. It's like, great, you listen to a record, but come on, let's go out now. You know, oh, no, they sit in, close the curtains and sit into another record and slowly dissolve into the carpet. Whereas, you know, the Jamaican kids were going, we're going to get charged and we're going to go out and we're going to go dance. And that's what we used to do. So we'd look out for clubs that had reggae or that sort of derivative of that music, yeah.
And when did you like start to understand or like realize that there were other like-minded bands popping up in other parts of England?
Well, funny you should say that. You know, that I forgot. You know, the Hope and Anchor. There was an article about this band called The Specials in this magazine called Melody Maker, which was where if you wanted to find a job, you had the back pages. You know. Drummer, the semi-professional ska band seeks, you know, all that shit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course I can. Yeah, of course I can play that. Yeah, go on. and the Specials turned up at the Hope and Anchor. They got a gig there. And that was the first time we saw them walking in, dressed exactly like us. And we didn't know whether to feel jealous or vindicated that we were onto something. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
They were a little bit older than us and a little bit better than us. And I must say, that gig was a mind blower. You know, that if you've ever seen the specials, you know, the energy. And then Limbaugh's blowing holes in the ceiling with a starting pistol. And it's like, this is it, man. This is where we're going. So that was the first time. Then, in fact, Jerry, who started the specials, started Two Tone, the keyboard player. Had nowhere to stay that night, so he stayed with me at my mum's flat. And in the middle of the night, he said, I'm going to start a record label, man. I've got this idea, like a British Motown. I was going, Jerry, you just played to 40 people in a pub basement. Don't you think that's a little bit optimistic? Right.
You're getting a little ahead of yourself, buddy.
Come on, mate. Let's go out of the 40-seater venue first, eh?
Yeah.
But 6 months later, he phoned me up and said, I've done it. I've started a label. And it was just the most, one of them synchronistic things, as I'm sure you will know and tell anyone else, it's that moment of luck, man. It's that moment of flipping luck. You know what I mean? We just recorded some demos that were kind of all right.
Yeah.
The first of which was The Prince, which had gone to be our first single. Then My Girl, which was the song that transformed us. And Madness, which was a cover of a Prince. But we'd done these three songs for $200. And we were just like, well, I think they sound, and then he rang up and he listened to Prince and he said, yeah, I think you should put that out as the first, well, the second single on Two Tone after the specials did Gangsters. But then the Two Tone tour started and we met all those bands at the Roundhouse, which was a famous venue in Camden Town. And it was as we were traveling around the country, you know, and again, without all the social media, the tour manager had to get off at the gas stations and ring up the venue, you know, in a phone box. And they go,
yeah,
geez, man, you got to find a bigger venue. This place, the kids are going crazy up here.
Really?
Like, we were going around the country and we were having
hits. Just sort of building in real time.
Exactly. In slow motion.
I mean, the footage of those shows look so fucking chaotic. It just looks mental. Like, was it more celebratory than violent?
Well, this is it, my man. You know, because this was just post-punk. And again, you think it was, to us, it seemed ages ago. But you think 76, 77. We're only into 79. So that energy was still there. But now it was being transformed into this slightly groovier way of going mad.
Right.
Definitely more euphoric than violence. But there was that edge. And sometimes fights would break out, for sure. Yeah, and you'd get one town had a thing with another town and they'd take it out on each other in a town in the middle somewhere. But no, mostly, and it's great, again, like I haven't seen that. There's a film called Dance Craze, which is that, I think, what you're alluding to, which is a film of that Two Tone tour.
Right.
I kind of forgot myself how completely maniacal it was. But I have to say, you know, there were things like Sulfate flowing about as well, you know what I mean? So there was...
Wasn't Dance Craze supposed to be like a Madness movie, and then you guys are like almost like not even in it? Didn't it start as a specifically focused on your band?
No, I don't think so, man. No, I don't think so. No, we did a film. We did a film called Take It or Leave It, which
Little
or Nothing. And the two things were kind of in parallel. Yeah, maybe there was a kind of crossover, but it just became a document of that. It was just about the live performance. As we did a kind of drama about how we started the band, which is a different thing altogether.
If the Two Tone scene was sort of the epicenter of it, was Coventry, were you guys always a little bit of like the outsiders in that world, or were you, or did it feel like that or not?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah, because they were all from what we call the Midlands. Yeah, the specials, what you alluded to, the Beat, Selector, all came from Coventry and around that area, and we were from London, firstly. Secondly, we were a little bit younger than all of them. So we were kind of like the sort of bus clowns, you know, but they all liked it. I mean, but then you had people like Rico, who'd been around since the 60s, you know, playing with the specials, who was 60-odd then on the bus. And I seem to recall on the bus, I think it was like the sort of speed was at the front. Then there was booze halfway, and then it was smoking dope at the back.
Where were you guys in that?
We were using every compartment, man. We were running up and down the aisle.
All the bands were on one bus together?
Yeah, man.
Oh, good Lord.
It was unbelievable. Because I remember getting to the Roundhouse and the bus was there and there were trombones and arms and legs and spliffs sticking out the window like something.
How did you keep your clothes together?
Oh, man.
That's like 100 dudes in like nice suits. How did that stay together?
Very difficult, man. And you'd be putting on a wet suit from the night before, you know, going like sort of smudging it down with an iron. Why are you wearing it? cold, wet suits, man. But I tell you what was difficult, though, is I don't know about you, you know, the early days are very hard to remember because there's so much adrenaline and you're just so much in the moment. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're not here to remember anything, man. You're here to really maximize what you're, the experience, you know. And I remember... Yeah. I was always on stage. I was always watching. I remember standing on the speaker stacks when the specials were on. All the bands would come on at the end. More often than not, the stage would collapse. I remember a couple of times we were all there. Wow. Like that. Our heads sticking out. But just an incredible time. I mean, also, you know, it's politically in a small way, but I think socially, black and white people in England, you know, it's still a struggle, as we all know, all over the world, racism and all that.
Sure.
I think it had a huge impact, that whole two-tone thing. You know, it was one of the first times that black and white musicians worked together, apart from the occasional, you'd see some West Coast bands, maybe, you know. But in England, it was very unusual. So that, I think, had a huge impact on society, I think.
Well, for a scene that was, like you said, like very multicultural, and even like a lot of women involved in some of the bands in that scene.
Yeah, yeah, that's it.
Why do you think that obviously had a real, like, you know, anti-Thatcher sort of, you know, bent to it? Why do you think, like, that whole National Front skinhead thing latched onto that scene that was so clearly didn't support it, you know?
You were making it more clear with the music we were playing. But that's a whole social phenomenon, because what we had here was, you know, football. And you had a lot of rivalry. You had what you call football hooliganism. So,
yeah,
for instance, in London, you got West Ham and Chelsea and Tottenham. And they were fighting all the time. It was just a sort of rite of passage when you're sort of 15 or 16. It was like a postcode, what they call now. You know, one area would fight another. Then the authorities came down really hard on that. You could go to prison for 6 months for being caught doing that at a football match. So they kind of moved on to concerts where it was a bit easier going. And for a while, you got these gangs. And it was almost like a fashion, this NF thing. It just sort of, but it's, fortunately, it sort of came and went. But I remember seeing a bit of it in LA, fun enough, when I got there. There was a sort of tinge of that with some of these bands. I can't remember who they are now.
Yeah, yeah.
This was the biggest irony, because, I mean, we got it worse because we were all white, you know, and so there was this kind of assumption that we were, and the way we dressed and our haircuts. But I remember the Specials got it as well, and the Selector got it as well. I mean, that was horrific. I mean, there were times when we played in front of an audience that was zigiling. You know what I mean? You just think, what the fuck is going on here? And me and Chaz Smash made the mistake of jumping in the audience to have a word. Well, he got kicked up the bollocks and I got a black eye, and that was the end of that. But we sort of knew that all we could do was explain that it just ain't right and play the music that we're playing. And eventually it went on to Oi Oi or some weird skinhead derivation of punk music. And fortunately, it just speared up its own arse.
You talked about football. Nowadays, you know, we have European football, and particularly Premier League, is super popular here in the States. And it wasn't back in the day. Like, and I remember, like, you know, when I first started getting into it, if you wanted to watch a game live, or if you wanted to watch a game at all, because it wasn't on TV here, you'd have to like get up at 4 a.m. and go find the British pub in whatever town you're in.
What was that?
Do that whole thing. Were you guys doing that on tour?
Oh, mate. We had to drag our tour manager out of bed at 4 a.m. in Santa Barbara,
Wow, no, that's where I'm from. Where'd you go?
There you go. With them smelly old seals and all that.
Yeah.
But I can't remember the pub. It was in L.A., the King something, and it was the only
King's
pub.
Head. King's Head.
A lot of Mexicans, because they were into football. So,
four
in the morning. The only thing they could get us was a white stretch limo. It was just like, for Christ's sake. First time I've been to a football match in a white stretch limo. But I remember, that's right. That was the only place to watch it,
yeah.
I still remember there were people like Billy Idol at that time. There was a few sort of Anglophiles knocking about in there.
Right, yeah. That's funny.
So what band were you in before the Foo Fighters?
Before I was in the Foo Fighters, I was in a band called No Use for a Name that was like a punk rock band. And the first time I ever toured over in the UK was around 1997. And I had read that Johnny Rotten book, No Black, No Dogs, No Irish.
Yeah.
And so, and I didn't know anything, you know, I just like from like bands that I liked, I would see like football scarves and strips and all that. So, you know, it just seemed exotic and cool. So because Rotten was an Arsenal fan, I just went, I'll be an Arsenal fan. And and ironically, the first time I went over to the UK, we had a day off in London and we went to go see Tottenham at White Hart Lane play Derby. Because the singer in the band that I was in was had a family connection to Derby. Derby County. So that was my first game. And that was like, you know, it was wild, man. Like getting on the train and coming out of the train station and you walk out onto the street and it's just a sea of people and everybody's in the same outfit and you're eating fish and chips and drinking a big can of beer. It's like, my mind was blown, you know, I was in.
When I was a kid, believe me, it was a very different scenario. It was just, I remember my friend saying he'd wake up in the morning scared and he went to bed flipping scared. He went out the front door with a Chelsea scarf on. You know, anything could happen. Yeah. And in those days, of course, it was standing. So people could go all the way around the stadium and they would. Someone like Millwall or one of the really horrible teams like West Ham.
Yeah.
It was a very dangerous place to be. Listen, man, I'm running out of time because I've got to do something.
And you know, there's so much more. I mean, it's
oh, well, the, I love
this, the, this is the trouble of interviewing somebody with a long, wonderful career. Is there's just too much to get to. So listen, I would love, let's do it again sometime for sure.
Absolutely, man. You're stuck for a guest. We do part two, no problem.
Yeah, buddy.
You sort of scratch the surface, don't you? And you kind of skip over things. And it's only when you think, oh, God, that leads to so many other stories I could tell. But anyway, thanks. That's been great,
Thank
man.
Thank you so much, man. Ministers. Yep, there it was. That was Suggs from Madness, the coolest of the cool. Make sure you go give their new greatest hits record a spin. It's fantastic. It'll put you in the good time mood. And we will be back in a week with another fantastic episode. And that's it, kids. Over and out. Adios, amigos.
It's gonna be rough. It's gonna be tough.